And welcome back, everyone. This is the second hour. We're talking with Dave Talbot from the Thunderbolts Projects. And of course, we're speaking on the Electric Universe. And before we proceed, I want to talk more with you about the symbol of the Saturn configuration and a lot of these things that, you know, has been going on. But are there any new developments lately, new exciting developments that have occurred of new, I guess, data that's been coming in that you guys have been looking at that have, you know, yet again confirmed some of the prospects of what you propose with your theory and everything else?
Oh, now are you talking about this reconstruction of the ancient sky that has been my own life's work, or are you talking about space age discoveries relating to the role of electricity in space? I mean, these things do overlap.
Yeah, well, exactly. I'm actually referring to any of it, any at all, if it's, you know, within any field at all.
My goodness. Now, that's a big question, Henrik. Yeah. And the first thing I would do is refer people back to the space news, because these things are coming out relentlessly.
Right.
And so you have events that you have the energies that are being observed at all scales, from our planetary scale up to the stellar scale of the sun and the interstellar scale within galactic formations. And then the role of galaxies to intergalactic space. The predictions of the Electric Universe, which are very diverse, come down to a core prediction. And the core prediction, since the Electric Universe is positing a crucial role for charged particles interacting and connecting all bodies in space, that core prediction is that wherever we observe electromagnetic activity, electromagnetic energies, those energies will be greater than the ability of prior theory to explain them. So right now we're observing the behavior of the sun at an extraordinary level of detail. You know, this is the most fully observed body in space.
Yeah.
We are measuring the acceleration of charged particles away from the sun. We are seeing that it's not just that the charged particles are accelerating up to hundreds of thousands of miles per hour. It is they are continuing to accelerate out past the planets. Now, why would that be? What in the lexicon of science could ever account for that in an electrically neutral environment where the sun is just this isolated island where everything that we want to understand about the sun has to be found inside the sun? This is a completely different question when you are looking at charged particles accelerated across interplanetary space. Now, what is it that accelerates charged particles in the laboratory? There's just one force that is business as usual in the laboratory, an electric field.
Yeah.
So we can take the electric field of the sun and we can take the acceleration of charged particles, I should say, and notice the relative accelerations close to the sun and more remote from the sun, and you can see a beautiful pointer to the relative strengths of the electric field. Close to the sun, extremely strong electric field, a very weak electric field out amongst the planets, but still an electric field continuing to slowly accelerate those charged particles. It would be an immeasurable electric field at, say, the Earth's distance from the sun. You know, you have to poke the probe somewhere. And nevertheless, the implied electric field across the heliosphere is sufficient to light the sun itself. It provides the aggregate electric power to light the sun. So how essential to the theories of solar physics today is the thermonuclear model of the sun? Most of the theorists exploring the electric sun hypothesis do not even believe that there is a thermonuclear furnace in the sun.
Right.
Just believe that if you accept an external electric field acting on the sun, all of the anomalous attributes of that body become predictable. None of those attributes are predictable under the standard model of the sun. This is all of these kinds of issues. And, you know, we look at planetary scarring. We look at the jets of comets. We look at the icy geysers, so to speak, of Saturn and the plumes of Jupiter's moon Io. These are all explicable electrically. None of them are adequately explained under the gravitational models that have been applied. And you take the jets of Enceladus, Saturn's moon Enceladus, these icy jets. Every time they look more closely, they have to go back to the drawing board. You know, a couple years ago, they were straining all credulity trying to explain these things by the interaction gravitationally of Enceladus with Saturn itself.
Right.
Somehow that was doing it.
Hmm.
And then they looked closely again. It was 10 times more energies than they had previously calculated.
Yeah.
These are charged particles. And that's the point, the core prediction of the electric model. If you're looking at an energetic event and it's registering electromagnetically, those electromagnetic energies are always going to be so far beyond the ability of the gravity-centric models to explain them. This is the consistent history of discovery in space.
So let me zoom out even more, even further than that, and ask you a little bit more about the nature of electricity itself. What do we know about what it is, what kind of force it is, and where it originates from?
Oh, shucks. You had to ask me that question. Can we call up Walt Thornhill now? If I dove into that subject, I would get so much wrong in the estimation of most people.
Right.
It'd only be embarrassing. But the point here is that scientists themselves debate all the time what electric currents are, what the electric force means, and so on.
Right. Yeah.
If you want to get a really compelling picture of what the electric force is, its relationship to magnetism, the role of the electric force at the quantum level, you know, down into subatomic particles, the relationship of the quantum role of the electric force to gravity. Walt Thornhill is having a huge impact now in his discussion of these things. The idea that gravity could actually be a nuance of the electric force acting at the subatomic level, well, this is actually a possibility toward which many theorists now are working. It does not allow you to think of gravity then in isolation from the electric status of a particular body. And if people will go to Walt Thornhill's website, HoloScience, I should mention that, H-O-L-O science, one word, and look up gravity and electricity, any combination of those two words, you'll find really enchanting discussion of how it is that the electric force between subatomic particles is able to explain gravity.
Interesting. Now, let's return a little bit then and talk more about, again, return to one of my favorite subjects, but the symbol of the Saturn configuration and how maybe we can just delve into that a little bit again of how that came about and you know, the myriad of consequences of what that's produced in cultures and everything around the world. But what were the elements comprised of at the time when this whole thing came about and occurred in our sky, Dave?
Yeah, now that's a huge question. And you stop me now, Henrik. I can get carried away with one thread and, you know, take up the rest of your time. But the point here is that there's nothing more important for humanity to know in its scientific interest and its human interest and its historical interest than the nature of the primeval human experience. This is simply off the map of modern understanding. It just it is as if we don't need to understand the origins of all the great myths and legends because it's just all too obscure. We use the word myth to mean not true. Well,
yeah.
A few thousand years ago, the stories being told meant something totally different. The stories were the connection to the culture to the most profound experiences that they would recount, the most profound. They meant the truth. They meant our connection to the gods. And how did this occur? What was meant by the age of gods and wonders? I mean, in different words, every culture remembered the ancient rule of the gods. These towering forms in the sky, they remembered the primeval sun, which ruled before the present sun. They remembered the golden age, this epoch of pristine harmony and equanimity on earth, and no seasons and this sort of thing. It's a memory preserved around the world. They remember the great catastrophe which brought the golden age to its violent end. They remember this flaming dragon in the sky punctuating the epoch between that primeval age and then this age of regeneration that followed. All these things are told in incredible detail. And if you descend to the particulars, you see that the coherence of the story is so far beyond anything that would be randomly developed by cultures independently. You see that it is an urgent and compelling message from antiquity being recounted, retold, reenacted, symbolically represented, you know, magically depicted in all of the early cultures. There was a provocation behind these magical practices and superstitions, behind these mythic images of powers in the sky that you can explore these in incredible detail. And just as I'm saying this, I think of the serpent or dragon. What was the serpent or dragon? There wasn't a culture on earth that didn't remember it. And it had this character. Well, why was it so biologically absurd? You know, a reptilian figure with wings, breathing fire, a countenance of fire, long flowing hair, a beard, feather serpent, and all that. Mm. Well, these defining attributes of the serpent make the point for us that every mythic archetype is a defiance of anything we actually experience. So here you have a contradiction of natural experience remembered around the world. And that's only the beginning, because if you pursue these details, just taking the serpent or dragon, for example, if you pursue them back to the original context, you see an incredible story that is so consistent, it has to have had a real provocation, something acting on human imagination around the world. The birth of that serpent or dragon from the heart of the ancient sun. I mean, this is so common. You go all the way back to Egypt and the Uraeus serpent. It was born as or from the heart of the ancient sun god Ra, the Uraeus serpent, the flaming serpent. And what was its relationship to the mother goddess? I mean, the prediction of the model is that feminine form of the serpent defined the history of the mother goddess, the star goddess, in this originally seen in the center of this huge sphere of the ancient sun god. And yes, the hieroglyph for the Uraeus serpent is the hieroglyph meaning goddess. None of this makes any sense. And what is the relationship of that goddess to the more famous warrior hero figures? Warrior hero figures are born from the womb of that goddess. Now, you can follow the history, I mean, just like the history of the goddess who becomes, in her angry aspect, this flaming feminine form of the serpent or dragon, you can follow the history of the warrior hero figure back to its first form in relationship to the pillar of the sky. It emerges from that form, emerges from the womb of the mother goddess as the great god Shu in Egypt, the first form of the warrior hero, becomes the pillar of the sky, holding aloft that whole configuration, holding aloft the stationary sun god, Ra. That is a global image of the world mountain, an acknowledged archetype, remembered in amongst all of the great cultures, a pillar or mountain rising along the world axis to support the domain of the ancient sun god, the exemplary ruler of the sky as the primeval sun, the great luminary to which all of the early lines of kings and so on would trace back in the chronicles of the different cultures, like Ra, always at the head of the line of kings. So there's coherence that you have to acknowledge in these global traditions that must have an explanation. So what happens if you actually take just the points of agreement as the signpost? You ignore all the local random evolutions of myth and symbols and so on. Just take the global accord, the points of agreement. That's the first ground rule of this investigation. It occurred to me very early in the first few weeks as I was seeing these common patterns and noticing that there were scholars who acknowledged these common patterns. I just realized, well, that's all I'm going to deal with. If it's a common pattern, I have to deal with it. If it's not a common pattern, it's, for all intents and purposes, a localized expression in the evolution of myth and symbolism that probably means nothing, more likely means nothing, but you certainly couldn't prove anything by just a local tradition somewhere. But when local traditions combine globally and they're combining on highly specific details, and those details are a total contradiction of anything that we would name or experience today, you have bedrock there. That is no more going to be explained by any theory of myth. It requires you to take that bedrock principle as what it is, bedrock. Mm. How many more bedrock principles are there? There are hundreds of them. Now, superficially, we call these themes, because we're not typically in the comparative mythology field, they're not dealing with anything concrete. So they just look past the concreteness and all the specificity. But if you actually start collecting and comparing and connecting these key story elements, that's where the jigsaw puzzle comes together in a perfect fit. It's one story told around the world, based entirely on the points of agreement between the different cultures. Now, to me, this is inescapable logic leading to an inescapable conclusion. Only the celestial provocation implied by this coherence will explain the bedrock of fact, which includes hundreds of mythic archetypes or points of agreement between the different cultures. So I believe that it's not just a testable hypothesis, that anyone who will actually take up the investigation, as several have, will reach the same conclusion as those who have taken up the investigation, that this is real human history and it is the most important thing for us to discover, the most important facts for us to know about humanity, the evolution of the earth, the rise of the early cultures, the nature of the early religions, and so on. The most important thing to know is, what was that celestial provocation?
Why is it, do you think, that most scientific-oriented people today seem to have thrown out these myths as as being untrue, or it's a delusion of the mind of the people in the past, etc., and not done the kind of work that you've done on it? Why is it most likely always thrown out in that way?
Well, I think it has to do with the perception with which the investigation has started. I mean, those who have actually facilitated a coherent reconstruction where following a certain reasoning process that would sound absurd to anyone who just carried into a glance or two at the ancient myths and so on.
Right.
The modern perception. I mean, myth means not true. That's what happened in the evolution of myth over time for this reason. As humanity became increasingly separated in time from those spectacular events, the records of those events appeared increasingly preposterous.
Yeah.
Just increasingly preposterous. And by the time of the Greeks, I mean, skepticism was rampant. Why would anybody believe this? Well, this is why the great tragedies and the dramas, all of which flowed out of this experience, they emerge eventually as comedy.
Yeah.
Because why would this be anything other than comic? You have this great warrior hero figure holding aloft the domain of the gods. I mean, try to reenact that on stage and not get laughs. You see, I mean, this is why Hercules, who was just an echo of the warrior hero figure, he became the harlequin. The whole story was just too absurd. So it became fodder for the writers of comedy.
Interesting.
That
yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, certainly. But what do you think about that separation process? I mean, if we look at over how long of a time that must have taken from us being in contact with the symbols, if you will, more directly visually in the sky, and the transformation of that into something that just became something of a passing of a distant memory, if you will.
Yeah, it was a passing of a distant memory, and indeed so. And you can actually follow that, and you can even follow it in the live in the characters of certain divine figures, starting with ancient Egypt or ancient Sumer or Babylon. You can follow their evolution over time. And so, I mean, you just take, for example, the Egyptian god Ra, the Egyptian god Shu, who is that first form of the warrior hero, or the later figure that emerged from this sequence of events in the sky as the kind of the prototype of the warrior king, the god Horus. Now, if you follow these figures down through the history of Egyptian civilization and Egyptian literature, eventually Ra has become a great king, having ruled on earth. And the god Shu has become his servant. And these figures, Shu and Horus, are the prototypes, obviously, the prototypes for the Greek figure Heracles, the Latin Hercules. Mm. And it's not a coincidence that Heracles was the name of the planet Mars. But it's that echo means nothing. I mean, until a person has worked systematically to identify the key story elements and believe that there is something in common in the experiences around the world, all one is getting is a total carnival of contradiction and confusion. But once you see that there is this substructure of human memory actually shining through that layer of the carnival,
yeah,
you can't let it go. You have to say to yourself, I mean, this is what has happened to those who have really gotten into this. You have to say, this is inescapable fact speaking to us through this clutter.
Yeah.
Inescapable fact, a human experience. It's still echoing to us across thousands of years, but we have to get down to that substructure of human memory, and it is simply and clearly defined by the points of agreement. See, every good detective knows this. Okay, he has 100 witnesses, and they're all saying 100 different things and so on. But then he finds, well, now, wait a minute. Here are several people. They've all said this. This is just too specific. It can't be an accident. Now, see, all we're doing really is just applying the logical proven principles of a good detective's approach to a mystery involving large numbers of witnesses and an underpinning of agreement on specific and highly unique details. And that's how you can separate the core of the original experience, still shining through, from the clutter of all this self-serving cultural evolution of storytelling and so on. I mean, it's an amazing thing to observe how mythology over time became a servant of the culture or the nation or the city-state, telling its stories. Well, we were the favored people of God. And all of that story is so obviously self-serving and our own warrior-hero figure, the warrior-hero that we preserved in amongst our tribe. Well, it gets to defeat all the other tribal warrior hero figures in these in these contrived chronologies of epic literature. I mean, and that's what actually occurred as chroniclers were gathering up these stories from neighboring cultures, neighboring cities and tribes, gathering them into, let's just say, an Iliad or an Odyssey piece of literature. What has occurred is that all of these figures were brought down to earth, and their stories were horrifically distorted by self-serving localization of the story elements. These people then are seen amongst all of their neighbors, echoes of the same figures that they have celebrated, but they give to their stories a dominance over all of the others, and they reduce all of the others progressively over time to essentially fragments of a story that was originally, for their neighbors and so on, the central story that defined the tribe or defined the nation.
Yeah.
Huge distortion that goes on over thousands of years.
Exactly, and the story becomes that the king now is born onto the earth, and the ruling king is in fact a representation of that original divine force. And then, of course, their own even personal story as they live out their life here on earth becomes weaved into the mythological fabric, if you will, which makes it even more complicated in that regard. But so is it, in your case, true that the closest to the source you can get, that's the more reliable and accurate version of it?
I'm glad you said that, Henrik, and that shows that you really do have a good sense of the nature of the reasoning process here. The reasoning requires us to identify the points of agreement, but when there is a common theme, let's just say the theme of the world mountain, because all self-respecting comparative mythologists recognize that that's a global thing. There was a great mountain rising along the world axis to the center of the sky, and on its top there was this great edifice of the gods. Well, that's localized. That mountain is localized as, well, amongst the Greeks as Olympus. And what does it mean then that that mountain was called, Mount Olympus, was called Aegeus, the axle. The local Mount Olympus gives you nothing to suggest an axle of anything, but the cosmic mountain was the axle. Now, what that point of agreement is giving you is a characteristic that you can be certain, once this falls into place, you can be certain that if you go back to the very first records of the cosmic mountain, that's going to stand out.
Yeah.
That's going to stand out. It's an axle. The heavens revolve around it. And that's exactly what the great traditions, I mean, the earlier traditions in Iran of Haribarzadi, around which it's the mountain around which the heavens turn. Same thing, Mount Meru amongst the Hindus, the mountain around which the heavens turn. The Mount Kunlun of the Chinese, the heaven, the mountain around which the heavens turn. So it can't be accidental that this local mountain on the edge of Macedonia called Olympus was called the axle. You see?
Yeah.
But the mountain story got localized, and by the time of the flowering of classical Greek literature and so on, that mountain had probably been localized for centuries, and it sounds like a local mountain when the poets and chroniclers describe it. But they still have preserved that point of resonance with the global tradition. It's just that you have to go back to the experience closest to the original events to see this imagery in living color. So go back to the pyramid texts of Egypt, go back to the temple hymns of ancient Sumer, and you see these forms in spectacular, urgently described detail. I mean, there was a sense of urgency and drama and a compelling urge to reconnect with the gods when the memory was very fresh in the minds of the ancient Egyptians and the ancient Sumerians, for example.
How fresh? Let me ask you that, because I wanted to ask you, I was thinking about something here. I was going to say, how many thousands of years, perhaps, do you think transpired before the stories were beginning to be written down, but maybe not then? Maybe it was closer than that.
I think actually they were surprisingly fresh when the Egyptians around 2600 BC inscribed the texts, the pyramid texts, on stone, you can see this by you can see the authenticity in the concreteness of the imagery, and the fact that virtually nothing has been localized yet. You see, it's when they begin to locate the gods as a great king in this mythical in this space over here, and the local mountain becomes the representative of the cosmic mountain, and the river down the valley becomes the representative of the nether river of fire, and so on. That's part of that picture. As that is transpiring, it is actually diluting the authenticity of the original cosmic imagery. And the beauty of the Egyptian pyramid text, which can't be long removed. I mean, maybe it's in the centuries, but I tend to doubt it. It could be in the centuries and just passed down let's just say by word of mouth for some period of time. But when I look at the Egyptian pyramid text, I see it's the closest thing imaginable to the events.
Interesting.
It's a little bit like the Egyptian pyramid text would be a little bit like, would be fairly close to this guy pounding on the stone to recreate a form that is still up there.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of the ancient petroglyphs and so on that are most authentic. They're actually recording formations almost certainly as they are occurring. And that includes particularly the electrical preludes, the plasma discharge formations in the sky before and after the main story of myths, which involve these huge forms clarifying in the sky above the sky worshippers. But you have lots of rock art that is just indicative of people inscribing plasma electric discharge forms in the sky. And this is being accepted now by an increasing number of people who are looking at rock art. These are electric discharge instabilities. Now, we haven't talked about my connection with Tony Perrat, who was the leading expert worldwide on plasma instabilities, but he was the one who helped me to see that the story I had reconstructed, I mean, he himself said that the story I had reconstructed can be verified electrically in the plasma discharge configurations that were named after him at Los Alamos, a Pratt instability.
Yeah.
But he also identified a range of electric discharge configurations that were clearly seen in the sky, and those were not, many of those were not explicitly connected to the story that I had reconstructed. But the bridges to the story that I had reconstructed were, in his statement to me, undeniable. In other words, there was a larger picture of human experience that is reflected in rock art around the world. And he was so completely convinced by my own presentation that he devoted the rest, most of the rest of his life, actually, to cataloging these images carved on stone and putting them into the Roadrunner computer at Los Alamos to recreate formations as seen from different positions on Earth. And he basically proved the point that rock art was not just stupidity or hallucination. It was humans on Earth carving electric discharge formations onto rocks. And when you have a computer putting the pieces of those configurations together and identifying a three-dimensional configuration, you know you're on the right track. So I got from Tony repeatedly a confirmation that what I had reconstructed was fully confirmed by his own work.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, same thing there when I watched the rock carvings up in Sweden and around Tanum and in these beautiful, you know, artworks, which when you look at them, you're just dumbfounded. What the hell is going on here, you know? And then
completely senseless. And that's why why the specialists in the field attempted to explain them as a kind of collective hallucination, shamanistic hallucinations, and so on.
Right.
But there are certain overlaps between those configurations and the forms that I myself had reconstructed involving a particular phase in the evolution of this configuration. And it related to the backbone of the sky, the chain of arrows form. That's how, in a matter of minutes, Tony Perrat's life, his life changed, because he had come to a conference in Portland in 2000 because he was such a distinguished plasma expert, and my presentation caught him by surprise. He stood up at a private gathering of speakers after the event, and he drew out this little image of embedded cones, and I said, Tony, that is the chain of arrows form that I'd puzzled over for years, discussed it with Wal Thornhill and so on. Wal was satisfied it was an electric discharge formation. What he had drawn out was a laboratory form of a plasma instability. And he then asked me how it evolved, and I said, well, it was two caduceus-like serpentine filaments spiraling up the axis and dividing into a stack of toruses. He said, that's the evolution of the Perrat instability.
Yeah.
And that's how, in a matter of minutes, his life changed. And within days, he was out there chronicling rock art, put together a substantial team of amateur archaeologists and others to gather thousands of rock art images. And that is why, when he put those images together and entered the data into the Roadrunner computer at Los Alamos, he could report back to me that the computer gave exactly what had been stated to him, exactly what I had stated to him in terms of this configuration. I called it the chain of arrows. It's an intimate part of the story of the warrior hero. He launches arrows into the sky. One arrowhead embeds itself in the one above it, and it forms a chain of arrows. It becomes the ladder of the sky. That's the stack of toruses. So I had good reason to speak of the chain of arrows, and it met perfectly with the evolution of the Perrat instability in the laboratory.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story how that all, you know, came about. Are you and Tony in regular contact still and work closely together, or?
No, actually we're not at all. And that is such a dismaying and sad story of how he was pressured into, I mean, he was, I hesitate to go into the details because you'd have to start naming people. But Tony Perrat was assaulted by, well, one individual in particular, who was going after all of his colleagues and so on. Yeah. And he was doing this relentlessly. With the result that one person, very well placed in NASA, went to Tony and said, what is all this strange stuff about? You just have to imagine somebody who wants to destroy an individual going after him through his colleagues who know nothing about the actual facts, nothing about them. And Tony just basically unraveled under the stress of that. He went in for an operation for back pain and ended up having to have a quadruple bypass.
Oh.
And this is just the worst possible story to have to tell, because Tony and I became very good friends. I mean, we got together, we celebrated all of this, and he was just, he was relentless in gathering up the rock art details, thousands of them. And to see that kind of pressure on a person from his own colleagues because they simply do not have a clue as to what he's working with, and they're responding to this relentless harangue from a critic or critics, and the productive life comes to an end. That's what actually happened there. At some point, because I have so many, I was just looking this afternoon at all my communications with Tony Pratt. When you see the inspiration that this man had based on the facts, things carved on stone, and then you see the way all of that unraveled over the last 3 years or so, it's just a story that has to be told coherently, and it is such a black mark. I mean, Henry, it's the blackest of black marks, what happened to Tony.
Well, that's very, very sad. But the work has continued it to a certain degree, though, anyway, right?
Oh, it has, yes. And one scholar I should mention, and I never mention his name without saying he's the most prodigious researcher I've ever known. I got to know him initially at the very gathering that Tony Pratt had come to. And he and Tony Pratt then actually collaborated on some material, including an article or two. This goes back a number of years, but these relationships emerged out of that incredible meeting in Portland, Oregon, where Halton Arp and Tony Pratt and Tom Van Flandern and Professor Don Scott and Wal Thornhill and I and Ev Cochran and Eduardo Cardona, some of the very familiar names, were all gathered there, and we realized that Tony Pratt was a tremendous discovery for us. I mean, that relationship just flowered. So Rens Vandersloos, 26 years old, at the time I met him, knew all these ancient languages and modern languages, and just a ball of fire. He went out and he studied the ancient myths and symbols, and he confirmed to me, even though he didn't want to, he would not accept, he allows for but does not accept the planetary identifications that I consider part of the bedrock, and that's a separate issue. But he said the configurations are there. This was up there. This happened. You can't study this material at the detail that is available to us and not see that those formations and that the evolution of those forms is fact.
Yeah.
It's actually factual history. That's Rens Vandersloos, or Marinus Anthony Vandersloos. He recently published 4 volumes on the origins of ancient myths from a comparative mythology standpoint. And what you see in his work is a substantiation of the very story that I had begun to tell way back in 1972 to 74 or 75.
Well, I remember we talked with Rens a couple of years ago now, more actually, and he was involved in a very interesting work of you know, combining the imagery from different parts of the world to see how they kind of correlated to each other, depending on almost like a form of triangulation, if you will, from a certain point of view of how we would have looked from different people at different parts of the world. And I just find his work absolutely fascinating in the way he...
Okay, excellent. I'm so glad to hear that. And actually, I was hoping that Renz could come to the conference. Now, that may not be out of the question, but it would be fantastic to have his contribution at our conference. So yeah. I'm going to tell him that we talked and you had mentioned that to me, and we'll see.
Definitely. Yeah.
The situation of his travel and so on doesn't work well with the schedule of our conference.
But I see.
I wouldn't write it off entirely.
Great. Excellent. Now, let's see here if there's anything else we want to, I mean, the story continues as always. I mean, we've talked many times now, Dave, and it's just every time it's so fascinating hearing about the work and how it continues and how it ties into the many different fields that the Thunderbolts project, you know, is involved in and all that. But before we give out some of the details again about the conference, before we end for this time, please let me know if there's anything else you'd like to, you know, give out or mention, or if there's another components to the work that you consider to be, important that you want to get out and finish off on here.
Well, now let's see. Of course, the Electric Comet documentary is being completed right now, and I did just put up Unlisted today an additional segment that grew out of Scientific Review of the Electric Comet documentary. And I think that will go public tomorrow. But that's just 7 minutes of additional material for the Electric Comet documentary. If you go to thunderbolts.info, you'll see a free documentary called The Electric Comet. It's right alongside Symbols of an Alien Sky, which has been out for a few years and is heading toward about 250,000 views now. But the Electric Comet is having a huge impact. We've already had, just in a few months, 180,000 views of that documentary. And there is also the story of electrical scarring of planets and moons. And the prime witness that I would cite here is on YouTube as the lightning scarred planet Mars.
Yeah.
There are two YouTube segments from a full documentary called The Lightning Scarred Planet Mars, and that's available. You can purchase that from Michamar Publishing, but we put a good portion of that, far from the full thing, but a good portion up on YouTube just to highlight the nature of the story, The Lightning Scarred Planet Mars. And I think what any of your listeners would see in those brief video presentations, I mean, I think they're about 15 minutes each, what they would see is the most compelling evidence that you cannot understand the planet Mars at all in terms of the supposed isolated evolution of the planet. It was immersed in electrical discharge activity. Well, that whole investigation came out of Symbols of an Alien Sky because it has Mars up there in this extremely electrically active configuration. And if you look at Symbols of an Alien Sky closely, you'll see that it was not just immersed in electrical activity. That electrical activity was along the axis of the configuration. It was hemispherically acting on the planet Mars. That caused me to have to look at the geology of Mars to see if something so preposterous as a hemispheric dichotomy might actually be present. And it is present to a profound degree. In fact, the northern hemisphere of Mars has been excavated miles deep.
Yeah.
I mean, you can know this because the southern hemisphere has just got craters all over the place and it's higher. But the northern hemisphere has almost no craters and it has experienced the removal of miles of material just excavated right off of the hemisphere.
Yeah.
So there's an integrity between the historical reconstruction and the planetary science of the electric universe, actually looking at the planetary surfaces and particularly the surface of Mars, to see that everything you would expect to find on the surface of Mars if it were immersed in electric discharge, you do find, I mean, right down to the trillions upon trillions of little blueberries that you can create in the laboratory only with electric discharge.
Yeah, it's very simple, and yet there's so much resistance.
we live with that now, Henry. But the amazing thing is that it's almost as if the collective consciousness of humanity is sort of deepening and extending.
Oh, sure.
As a rule, when a video goes up, in a matter of days and weeks, it peaks out and then it starts going down. If you look at the last months of Symbols of an Alien Sky, I mean, we put it up a little over a year ago for free. The last couple of months, it just keeps going up. We're getting, it's like 1,000 views a day of Symbols of an Alien Sky. And I've never seen anything like that with a video that is just up on YouTube, and a year later, it's getting more views than ever.
It means that people are coming to it, and they're coming around, you know?
Yeah. There's something that is happening organically, some higher level of receptivity to the nature of the story.
Yeah.
Something is implied by the actual performance record of the video on YouTube.
Well, it's really encouraging to hear that. And I mean, all the work that all of you guys do at Thunderbolts, it's so important and so fascinating and such an important component to, the human story and the backstory of, you know, why we are the way we are, where we come from and how we interpret things and everything in between up to the biggest components of the universe that we can see and not see. So I'm always thrilled to have you on, David, and talking about the work, because it's very, very fascinating. Now let's again give out some of the details about the conference here, and so people know where to go when they are curious and want to sign up and attend.
Yes, I hope to see some of your listeners there. In fact, I've met some of your best listeners at our conferences, Henrik. So the event is the Electric Universe or EU 2014. All about evidence. That's the centerpiece theme. If you go to thunderbolts.info, you'll see a big banner for the conference on the home page. And on the sidebar on the right, you'll see the logo for the conference and a menu beneath it for conference home, the registration, speaker, schedule, locations, and so on, special events, everything. And everything you would want to know about this conference actually can be accessed off this website. The speakers list is still growing, but just look at the speakers that are named there already. You'll see this is a very impressive group of people. And I can tell you, these people, they are coming in under a sense of huge inspiration. In fact, Henrik, we've had two annual conferences so far. This is our third. One theme was the overriding response on both conferences previously.
Mm-hmm.
This was the most inspiring event I have ever been to. I heard that from dozens of people. Now, that's the truth. This is the most inspiring event I've ever been to.
That's great.
Or others would say, I mean, Rupert Sheldrake said, I've been through an intellectual revolution.
Was he there last year?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. That was great. Well, great.
I love Rupert Sheldrake.
Yeah, he's a great guy. We had him on a while back. It's that's great that he's coming into the kind of work that you guys are doing. That's awesome.
Yeah. He expressed great admiration.
Excellent.
The presentations and so on.
Thunderbolts.info. Don't forget it. Go there. We're going to have it linked up. Check out the conference. And there's so much more material there for everyone who is not familiar with the work of the Thunderbolts project to just dive into, and all the YouTubes and everything else, and check out the books and stuff like that. And we'll have plenty of links up on our related page there. So do check that out. But all right. Well, Dave, thank you so much again for coming on. And we'll see you in Albuquerque then between the 20th and the 24th.
I'm looking forward to that.
Me too. Very much.
Thank you very much. And this is, there's just something about your style, Henrik, I have to say. It's wonderful, actually, to be in conversation with you, and you certainly do give me a lot of room to just
we love
go
to do that.
On one tangent or another.
Oh, definitely. No, that's the point. We want to hear you speak, and we want to hear your story as well. So thank you again, Dave. Thank you so much.
Thank you now.
If you haven't heard our previous interviews with David Talbot, please see our related shows on this program page, or just do a search on redicemembers.com and have a listen. Some much more in-depth concepts explained in those programs. Some really good stuff. Before we end for this time, let me give you some names of some of our upcoming guests. Walter Block, Dan Fogler, Rick Falkvinge, Richard Dewhurst, Ben Davidson, Robert Felix, Sophia Smallstorm, and John King. Some great shows coming up, so stay with us, everybody. And of course, if you haven't already, you can subscribe to our RSS feeds and let our latest programs come directly to you. All right, guys and gals, thank you for being a member and thank you for listening. We'll talk to you then in just a few days. Be well and take care. See you later.